This was Common Sense with Corinna Horton on 610 KDAL. The number here is 722-0839. And if you'd like to call toll-free, it's 888-KDAL-610. This hour, we're going to visit with Tom Greer. He is the executive director of MIBDEC. It's a local Minnesota nonprofit organization to help educate doctors and patients about Lyme disease. Tom, welcome to our show.
Oh, hi.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Tom is a graduate of the University of Minnesota Duluth in 1977 with a double degree in biology and chemistry, and then continued on with 2 years postgraduate work in clinical immunology. That's one of the things I always have to work on is the pronunciation of certain words.
Medical words are tough.
Yes, at UMD Medical School, and then 1 year postgraduate work at the University of Washington and the Puget Sound during research under a grant from NASA in geriatrics and the effects of nutrition on bone wasting. From there, he went to work in the pharmaceutical industry until he was misdiagnosed with MS in 1990 and was disabled. He did not return to work for 6 years until he was treated aggressively and long-term with antibiotics. Today, he still suffers from heart and brain damage. Welcome, Tom. I appreciate you coming to the studio. I think this is a very, very important topic that everyone out there needs to hear, because you don't know if you're going to be infected with Lyme disease. You don't know if you're going to have a loved one that's going to be infected with Lyme disease. We have ticks up here. It is definitely an area where we have to be aware of this and aware of the symptoms and aware of the misdiagnosis that can
absolutely
take place.
And it's important not to take it too lightly, because I think that a lot of people think, oh, Lyme disease, it's no big deal. And maybe for the vast majority of people who are bitten and treated, that's true. But there's those that fall through the cracks, and that's where the controversy begins with Lyme disease.
Well, let's talk about you and what you went through when you first was diagnosed with MS, some of the symptoms that you had displayed that made them think that you had
multiple sclerosis. Well, I had a lot of symptoms, and not all of them were related to multiple sclerosis. I started out actually with some heart problems, and as with the doctors I was working with, every now and then they'd throw me on a treadmill and such, and they'd look at these things, and they said, well, you need to see a cardiologist. And cardiologists would say, well, I don't know what this is, we'll wait. And it was like that with everything, ear, nose, and throat, eyes. Eventually, I started getting pressure in my head, just a complete debilitating pressure in my head. My vision had shrunk to a spot in front of my eyes to about the size of a basketball. I was having extreme hearing disorders with noise and such going on. I was having seizural disorders. I was having numbness and tingling in my hands and feet and scalp. And eventually I was not able to drive, and actually it got to the point where I was not able to stand in an upright position for more than maybe 5 or 10 minutes without actually having passed out. I could not control the blood flow into my brain. So I had heart problems. I had myocarditis. I had myocardiopathy, an enlargement of the heart. I had all of these problems, but they seemed to want to say, oh, well, it's MS. And like that solved everything. And I'm thinking, well, I've just never heard of an MS patient that has all these other symptoms. I collapsed in the street and was taken to a hospital here in Duluth, and my physicians were on vacation, essentially, and the physician that came on board Monday morning had just come that night from an international Lyme conference in Arlington, Virginia, and that neurologist said, you know, I don't think this is MS at all. I think we're going to have to look at Lyme disease. And after 2 years of struggling with all my symptoms, she, in 5 minutes, looked at my chart and had determined that this has to be what it is. And she was absolutely right.
Wow, what a miracle to have that happen, how sometimes life intervenes like that in having someone different look at you and then somebody who had had an experience and some education just the night before.
And prior to that night, and she told me that she would have not known a thing about Lyme disease. In 1990, there was really no internet like we know it today. There was really not the knowledge that we have today. But I would say that all in all, the doctors have less than a complete picture of what Lyme disease can really do.
Well, what I know about Lyme disease is very little. It's just that you develop a rash, is what I've heard, that you get some spot where the tick has maybe been, and there's a rash that develops. That to me is the only knowledge that I really have of it, besides the other that you have symptoms and different things like that. But what are the symptoms of Lyme disease?
Well, we kind of started off on the wrong foot with understanding Lyme disease to begin with. It is caused by an infected deer tick that bites a person. If a tick hasn't fed, people are a great place to get a meal, and so that's where they're looking to. And they inject the bacteria into your bloodstream, and that's where things begin. Now, the lucky patients do get a rash, a bullseye rash, or what we call an erythema migrans rash, but not everyone does. And also children who are rolling around in the grass and such might be bitten in the head, and then the rash might be under their hair. You might never see it. But half the patients never remember a tick bite or a rash before the first symptoms come on. Also, you might be bitten in April or May and not have your first symptoms show up until July or August. And that's the most common scenario. So trying to connect the 2 months later is also difficult.
Okay, what is it that the tick actually puts into your skin that causes this disease to occur in a human being?
Well, it's a spirochetal bacteria that looks like, under the microscope, it looks like syphilis. Spirochetal bacteria are found in a lot of ticks. It also causes relapsing fever, which is the first cousin to Lyme disease, and Lyme disease. And the bacteria is called Borrelia burgdorferi, named after Willy Burgdorfer, who isolated it in 1981.
Okay, I see here in 1973, Lyme disease was first described in Old Lyme, Connecticut, by two housewives who felt that they were seeing too much juvenile rheumatoid arthritis in their local kids. And so this is how it first began. It was parents that started questioning why these kids were all having rheumatoid arthritis.
Well, they were very frustrated. And Polly Murray and Judy Mensch went through Old Lyme, Connecticut, and they said, these kids do not have juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. They have too many symptoms, and there's too many cases. Well, everyone blew them off for years and years until 1973. They actually collected through the neighborhood thousands of case histories and such of tick bites, rashes, and the histories of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Took it to the CDC, and they found that the cases were 8 to 20 times more frequent than it should be. And so they sent an investigator to look into it, and in 1975, Alan Steer coined the name Lyme arthritis and also declared a treatment and a cure 6 years before we even knew what caused Lyme disease. So we had an idea that it was a bite of a tick. We had an idea that it responded to antibiotics, but we didn't know what kind of bacteria it was. And that's where we really got off on the wrong foot, because we started treating it like it was a sore throat rather than the disease that it is. And the disease that it is even more insidious, I think, than a lot of syphilis cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, and is Lyme disease curable?
Well, that's the big controversy. In fact, just now released is Pam Weintraub, a science reporter for Discover Magazine, wrote a book called Cure Unknown, and it's all about the controversy of Lyme disease. It's still in hardcover, and it's an excellent read if you want to know about the intricacies of this disease. But there are absolutely documented cases of people who have been treated for months and months and even years where we can isolate the bacteria. And I have one case history right here on the laptop. And this is what's so difficult to understand, is a bacteria that can survive in the human body for a decade or more can cause a whole different set of symptoms than what we see the day of the tick bite. Yeah, we're looking at a whole different set of symptoms than you would see with a tick bite, the arthritis, the flu-like symptoms, and so on early in the disease. So we have to look at it as a progressive disorder in these patients.
Well, and can Lyme disease, I know there's no, we're talking about possibly there might not be a cure to this, but can people, their bodies, their own immune systems, defeat this type of bacteria that comes into their bodies?
Well, I think most people who are bitten by an infected tick actually handle it better than others. I would say that it's a smaller percentage of people that go on and have the kind of complications that I had. But one of the misunderstandings that physicians and lab techs and other people have is that they'll look at the laboratory analysis of a patient's blood, and they say, oh, this patient's antibody level is 2,000. They must be really, really sick. But what is that actually measuring? It's measuring natural immunity. And then they look at this patient who comes in and they can barely walk, they're half blind, they're crippled, and they have a negative test completely. They have no antibodies whatsoever, but they have a history of a tick bite, a rash, and the physician says, well, I can't even treat you because under our protocol, you have to have two positive tests, and you know, you can't even have Lyme disease go away. You must be faking it. Well, the difference is that person that has the very, very high natural immunity has less symptoms and less problems than the patient who has the negative test.
Let's talk a little bit more about that when we return from our commercial break. We are talking with Tom Greer. He is the executive director of a Minnesota nonprofit organization to help educate doctors and patients about Lyme disease. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL.
But the idea of the thinking back then was you treat for 2 weeks and the patient is cured and you don't have to treat again, especially if you treat with IVs. But this is a very slow growing bacteria, and with the medication that they used, they could only kill it when the bacteria is dividing. And this bacteria divides 72 times slower than other bacteria. So using that 2 week figure is misleading because you can only kill it when it's dividing. And to get the same kind of lethal exposure during division time with this bacteria as opposed to, say, a sore throat, you would have to treat for about 2 years.
Okay, so now are you being treated for Lyme disease at this day and time?
I am not. No, okay. I've been antibiotic-free for probably 7 or 8 years.
Okay, wow. And so how long did you have to, did you go through the treatment process yourself?
Well, it was probably longer than it needed to be because the doctor would treat for 2 weeks, and then they say, well, let's see what happens. And then you get sick again, and they say, oh, I don't even know what this is. It must not be Lyme disease because it's more. And you go through this kind of process. By this time, I was disabled, and I had read up on a lot of Lyme disease. And in 1990, there was not good information on the Internet, so I had to go to a lot of conferences, which I did. I've gone to probably 20 international conferences and medical conferences on it. There was a drug that was available in Mexico that's not available here called roxerythromycin, and it gets into the brain about 50 times better than the medications they were using here. And I would say from the second or third day I was on that drug, I could feel this amazing difference.
So did you have to go to Mexico to get this drug?
No, I was pretty sick. Traveling was not really a good option for me. People don't understand how much work has been done by other pioneers. And back then in 1990, there was a group, the AIDS patients were very political, and they could not get the medications that they needed. Medications were very expensive. And so they got legislation passed that they could import drugs that were not available in America to treat AIDS. And they formed what were called People with AIDS Buying Groups. And I contacted one of these groups, and I said, you know, I've heard about this drug that could... It's into the brain, we can't get it here. And Ken said, oh, it's a really excellent drug, but I can't help you. You're not an AIDS patient, there's restrictions and stuff. And then the very next day, I received a Federal Express package from him with $700 worth of medication, and what a difference it made. So he kind of bent the rules. And
you're here today to tell your story.
I would. And, of course, there's no such groups today, people with AIDS buying groups, because they have opened the doorway to Mexico and importation. More drugs and more therapies are available. The Internet is up and running, so more information is exchanged. But back then, it was a very difficult time.
Now, can people get this drug for Lyme disease at this current day?
They can, but now other drugs have been available in America that are somewhat similar that'll do the job. The main thing is getting diagnosed earlier, treated more aggressively and longer with the medications we have. One of the cheapest medications that is out there is amoxicillin, and it will do the job, but you have to treat until all the symptoms are gone.
Well, we have to take a news break right now, but when we return, let's continue our discussion on Lyme disease. And if anyone has questions, Tom is here. You definitely are an expert in many ways. Not only have you lived through it, but you also have the education and the background that can help support your ideas and your thoughts and where you're at today. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. The number here, if you'd like to call in, is 722-0839. Our toll-free number, 888-KDAL-610. We have Jim on the line. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I have a question for Mr. Grant.
Okay.
And the question is, I'm from Ashland, and I was diagnosed recently with Lyme disease. But here's the thing. I had like 8 ELISA tests, which is a screening test for Lyme disease, and they were all negative, so the doctors would not treat me. And I finally found a doctor that was somewhat knowledgeable about Lyme disease, and he gave me this test called a Western blot, and it was positive, and then I got started to get treatment and got well. My question is, why do they keep using this ELISA test if it's unreliable? And I'll hang up and get off the phone.
All right. Thanks for your call, Jim. Tom?
Well, thanks, Jim. Yeah, that's one of the biggest controversies in Lyme disease is we have seemed to what's called two-tiered testing with a screening protocol using a test called the ELISA test. And the ELISA test has been under scrutiny for 20 years. One of the problems is we have Lori Bakken, a PhD from Wisconsin, who tested 516 laboratories, and she took highly positive triple-paired samples. So all three samples were identical. She sent them to the labs, and all three should come back positive. And what she found was less than 50% of the labs could have a consistent result, and half the time they said these positive results were actually negative. So it has a history of being a bad test, and you don't want your first screening test to be worse. Something that's only 50% reliable is no better than flipping a coin. Now, the second test you mentioned is the Western blot. Now, both these tests look for the antibody production in a patient after they've been exposed to Lyme disease, and they're looking for Lyme antibodies. So it's an indirect test and an indirect measurement. It cannot directly tell you the bacteria is in your body. But what's nice about the Western blot is on a piece of filter paper, we sort out the antibodies by their weight, and we can say, oh, this antibody at 39 is specific for Lyme disease only, and it can't be anything else. So if you have that particular band, then we can say this has to be Lyme disease. But there was a conference in Dearborn, Michigan, 1995, which said, well, we're going to standardize the Western blot reporting, and it doesn't matter that you have one or two of these very significant bands. We want 5 out of 10 possible bands, and we're going to eliminate 3 of the most important bands because the vaccines that were being developed at the time might use those particular antibodies or proteins. So we're just going to eliminate those and pretend they're not even there. So the Western blot has become a less than reliable test. Now, as far as having your negative tests, what could have happened is you're exposed to the tick, you're bitten, the bacteria is in the bloodstream for a short time, then it goes into the deeper tissues of the body, and your bloodstream stops making antibodies. Then they administer the ELISA test and the Western blot, and you have very poor results. Now, after a while, though, the physician might treat you with antibiotics, and it kind of stirs the pot a little bit. You start breaking up this bacteria. The immune system kicks in a couple weeks later, and then you do a test, and all of a sudden, these bands start appearing again. And this is very difficult for non-science people to understand. They think, oh, there's a test. It must work. But that's not the case. It depends when the test is given, how it's given, and how you're going to interpret that test. So I'd say you were very lucky to have a doctor that really understood those things and looked at your Western blot and said, well, this has to be Lyme disease. And I take it you responded to treatment as well.
Well, let's talk about some of the symptoms that a person can identify themselves, because we really do walk around as our own physician first in some ways. Now, we can always get it wrong because we're not doctors, but we know our bodies better than anybody else out there knows what's going on. So what are some of the symptoms of Lyme disease that people can be aware of?
Well, I wish there was a definite timetable where you could say, well, you're bit by the tick and you're definitely going to have the rash now and you're definitely going to have this symptom and so on. But a lot of the symptoms may actually take months or even years to show up. But what we generally say is once you're bitten by a tick, you may develop a bullseye rash within about 30 days. This red expanding rash does not hurt. It's not raised. It's not too alarming. And sometimes you may have multiple rashes. The bacteria may circulate through your bloodstream and then resurface in the skin again, and you have multiple rashes. And even without antibiotics, these rashes will fade and go away. But during this time, you might also have a slight fever. You might have a flu-like illness. You might have muscle aches, joint pain, and extreme fatigue. But later, you might find that you have mental disorientation, that you're forgetful, and you might have visual troubles. And one symptom we see so often in patients that goes away with antibiotics is when they turn their neck to the left or the right, there's a crunching in their neck. And then shortly after antibiotics, this just disappears. So we think that's related to Lyme. I'd say over half the Lyme patients I talked to had that symptom. The symptoms that can happen in late stage Lyme are so varied that they can be mistaken for so many things. You can have visual disturbances, hearing disturbances, taste disturbances, tooth pain. You can have heart palpitations, tachycardia. I have an ongoing problem. It damaged my heart. I have a condition called atrial fibrillation. And I go off my medication at all, I'm back into atrial fib. Now it's all due to Lyme. I also had symptoms that are not common in Lyme, like pressure in my head. But the most common long-term symptoms that we see in late stage are extreme fatigue, depression, and memory problems.
Can you even recall when you had the tick on your body? Can you recall something like that? Because you look back, I'm sure you were struggling for 6 years and being misdiagnosed. And then once you knew it was Lyme disease, could you remember any incident?
Well, you wouldn't know it to look at me now, but I used to run a lot, and I used to run in the woods and Hartley Field and Chester Park and all these places. And prior to 1990, I had gone camping in the Wisconsin Dells, and my physician says, well, that must be where you got it. But I actually took an attached tick that was on my arm into my physician in Cloquet that I had gotten in Chester Park. And she said, now, this is 1988, there's only a 3% transmission rate if you get it. There's a test. Don't worry. It's easy to diagnose, easy to treat. And then 2 years later, I'm completely disabled.
So you actually went in and saw somebody for this tick, thinking that you may have had Lyme disease.
I actually did, and I actually got complete misinformation.
Oh, that's really sad. We've got a caller here online right now, and we are going to take that call. Good morning. Is this Marina?
Yes, this is Marina.
Hi, Marina. Do you have a question or comment for Tom?
Yes. Tom, would you be able to talk about the co-infections that come with Lyme disease? I hate to complicate the picture, but I think it's important for the listening audience.
All right.
And I'll get off the phone.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Marina. Yeah, it's an excellent point to bring up. The deer tick that bites us is actually a dirty little cesspool of bacteria. There's a lot of things that are in that tick, and not just Lyme disease. Recently here in Duluth, a physician, Johann Bakken, had isolated a bacteria known as Ehrlichiosis, and it causes what's called human granulocytic Ehrlichiosis. But now we call that disorder in humans anaplasmosis to differentiate from the animal diseases like that horses get. So Ehrlichiosis is something that attacks the white blood cells, and you can have a very quick drop in your neutrophils or granulocytes, and that makes you more susceptible to other infections. If you're bitten by a tick with ehrlichiosis, the first thing is you usually get symptoms within 3 days. You often get high fevers and can have some GI problems, and you might have other complications with that. Ehrlichiosis is generally treated with doxycycline quite successfully. But a third co-infection, babesiosis, which is a sort of a parasite that attacks the red blood cells, can be much more tenacious, and it's more difficult to detect, more difficult to treat. And one study in Rhode Island showed that those patients that had both babesiosis and Lyme disease together had a 69% chance of having chronic Lyme disease, whereas if they just had Lyme disease, only 7% of the patients went on to have chronic Lyme disease.
Well, we have another caller here. John, you are on the air with Common Sense with Corinda. Do you have a question or comment for Tom?
A comment, actually. Thanks, Corinda.
Thank you.
I got some really good advice this weekend when I was at a Cub Scout training for deer ticks and regular ticks, is to use a credit card to scrape them from the butt side up to detach them and get them head up. And then once you get them off, circle it with a permanent marker so that you know where to look in the future as you're watching for that target dot. And by the time the permanent marker wears off your skin, the likelihood of the Lyme disease kicking in lessens. And that was offered by an EMT.
All right. Thanks, John.
Yeah, thanks, John. That's very good advice. The main thing that we want to avoid when having an attached tick is grabbing it by the body and squeezing it, because that can act like a syringe and you're actually injecting the infection into your body. We also want to get all the head and the mouth parts out, so lifting the tick body, isolating the head, pulling it out is good. And then, like you say, if we get a rash, that rash tends to expand, and we want to see the margins of expansion so you can go to the doctor and say, well, this is an expanding rash. The caveat that I would put in is if you've got an attached tick, I think, in my opinion, you should go to the doctor and get at least a few days of antibiotics, if not 2 weeks, because what are the consequences? I've had a lifetime of consequences, so I would say 2 weeks of an antibiotic after a tick bite is a small price to pay.
Well, and what are these ticks, you know, a lot of times I'm picking ticks off my kids all the time. I mean, we live by the woods, there's ticks out there, and you'll see a big, huge, massive tick. Now, is that, they say that the Lyme disease-carrying ticks are small and little. Is there truth to that?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know what this massive tick it is you saw. It reminds me of when I lived in Tacoma, Washington, and the first time I ran in the woods, I saw this huge creature, and I said, you have to see these things, and I brought it back, and they said, yeah, that's a banana slug. And I said, no, slugs in Minnesota are this big. Well, the deer tick is very small. When they're actually hatched as a larva, they're much smaller than, say, an average period on a page of a paper. The next year, they'll molt into a nymph. They're a little bit larger, and it's this nymphal stage where they're voraciously hungry in the spring that they'll bite just about anything to get a meal. And then they'll molt again, and they become an adult. And the adult deer ticks are a little bit larger, but they're still smaller than an average dog tick. And once a dog tick and a deer tick, though, feed and they're engorged, they get to be about the same size. And it's very difficult to tell the difference between an engorged deer tick and an engorged dog tick. But generally, a nymph tick that's bitten in the spring will be a little bit bigger than the size of a period in an average sentence.
Okay, so that is quite a bit smaller than the ones that I've seen. And is there a different coloration? Because the ones I normally see, they're more of a darker brown.
Yeah, the darker brown with the white stripes is the Dermacenter dog tick, Dermacenter variabilis. And that dog tick looks kind of like a watermelon seed and about the same size. The deer tick is much smaller and has a reddish body with a black, what they call scapula, circle on by its head. And that is the deer tick. But the main thing is you look at the size.
Well, we're going to take a commercial break right now, but when we return, we're going to continue our discussion with Tom Greer. He is the executive director for MIBDEC, a local Minnesota nonprofit organization to help educate doctors and patients about Lyme disease. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL, and we are visiting here with Tom Greer. He is with the MIBDEC. What does that stand for?
Well, it's a terrible name, but our lawyer said if you put the words Minnesota and education in the same title, you're more likely to get a nonprofit clearance, which is what we did. So it's Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council.
Okay.
Yeah, and at the bank, it's like a nightmare. We can never find our own account.
Yeah, I bet. So this is a local Minnesota nonprofit organization. It helps to educate doctors and patients about Lyme disease. We have 10 minutes. I'm going to keep you past the news. I know you probably have to get somewhere, but I know there are people out there that probably still have questions, and I want to make sure that the people who are out there that have questions or comments on this have an opportunity to call you, and then we can certainly have you on again, but since we have you here now, I'm going to keep you here if you don't mind. This to me is very fascinating because for one reason is that, you know, I have these kids that like to play in the woods. You know, we live up here in northern Minnesota where there are so many ticks out there. Certain times of the year, there's more of them. Ticks generally spring and fall, is that correct?
Well, yes and no. We have a hatching in the spring of the nymph ticks, and they're voraciously hungry, and this is where we're more likely to be an accidental meal. A human comes along, they sense our heat, our carbon dioxide. They don't care what we are. They just bite us and feed on us. In the fall, we have adults that meet on the deer or any large animal, and that's where the mating process begins. And this is where the female also has to get a final meal to get the energy to create eggs for the following spring. So the deer are kind of like a club med. This is where adult mm-hmm. ticks meet and get it on. And but you can be infected any month of the year. On a warm day in the winter, if a tick emerges because it's warm out there, it comes out from under the brush or whatever, or comes in on an animal and it has not fed yet, you can certainly get Lyme disease. And we have actual incidences of people being bit in every month of the year.
All right, well, we have a caller right now, so we're going to go ahead and take that call. This is Violet, that you are in Common Sense with Corinda Horton. Good morning, Violet.
Morning. I have had Lyme disease for about 15 years. I was diagnosed by a doctor that was very knowledgeable in it, and he left the area. And I'm wondering if Mr. Greer is going to give us names of doctors in Duluth area that can treat it.
Well, I really can't do that. What I would say is come to the support groups and discuss with other patients what their options are. Our support group here in Duluth meets the first Tuesday evening of every month at 7 o'clock at St. Luke's Hospital on the third floor in the East Clinic building, and we've been there for over 10 years.
How about Cloquet?
Cloquet, that support group, Linnell Lamy passed on, and that support group kind of folded up. So as far as I know, there's no support group in Cloquet at this time.
Give me the other one in Duluth again, please.
The one in Duluth, you can contact me at 728-3914.
Okay.
We meet at 7 o'clock the first Tuesday of every month. Okay. And you'll meet plenty of patients that have a similar story. Lyme for years, their physician stopped treated or has moved away, and difficulties ensue.
Okay, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you very much for your call. And so she's had it for 15 years. Now, how long does the Lyme disease, can you live with Lyme disease?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I don't know why more researchers aren't extremely interested in this bacteria. It's one of the most fascinating bacteria that's ever been in existence that we know that causes human disease. We know from experience, from patients that have been bitten, have had a rash, and never treated, that this bacteria can live in the body for three decades. I mean, at least three decades. We've gone back to those original rash sites and actually been able to culture the bacteria out of the skin. Now, some of these patients might have had milder symptoms because they had some degree of natural immunity. But one of the cases I remember, he was 54 years old, had never been treated for Lyme disease. He was a farmer, couldn't even operate a calculator. And after 6 months of antibiotics, he said, I felt like I was 18 years old again. And they were able to isolate the bacteria out of one of the original rash sites.
Yeah. Is it possible that people will be prescribed an antibiotic for something else and then they'll find themselves being treated for something they didn't know they had?
Well, absolutely, and part of that, it can be part of the diagnostic process. Patients that have spirochetal illnesses like relapsing fever and syphilis and Lyme disease, when they first start treatment, they can have what's called a Jarisch-Herxheimer reaction, which is a reaction by the body that makes them feel worse. They might have fevers, sweats, fatigue, fuzzy thinking, but generally they feel much worse after the treatment. And that can say to the doctor, well, something's going on here. Is this really a sore throat, or do they have something else going on? And so looking at that Herxheimer-type reaction, a person might be able to pursue Lyme disease, too.
Well, we have another caller here that has a question for you, Tom. We have Dorothy on the line. Good morning, Dorothy.
Good morning. Good morning. What a wonderful program this is.
Well, thank you.
How do we get a hold of a tape of this program?
I wish I could say you could get a tape, but it's a live show.
Okay, and you can't tape it.
No, we could, though. You know, what we should do is we'll have Tom on again, and we'll make sure we tape it. It might not be exactly the way it went this hour.
Doctor, I have a sister that's right now up in Alaska, but has been going through almost what you're talking about for years now. And what I want to know is what day is it you meet, and do you have any literature you send out?
Well, I tend to be more on the research side of things, but in our support group, there is literature available. If you want to know about the controversy of Lyme disease, I would recommend a book by Pamela Weintraub called Cure. And she's a...
known about the controversy for quite a long time. But what my sister started with Bell's palsy, and that's the first we knew about it, and she never was cured of the Bell's palsy on both sides of her face.
Yes. Bilateral Bell's palsy, over 90% of the time, is caused by Lyme disease, and that was shown in a East Coast study that was done almost 15 years ago, probably. One of the reasons a patient will get facial paralysis is that the cranial nerves that go through the skull are the closest exposed to the skin and are at lower temperatures. And early in this infection, the bacteria likes to go to those parts of the body where it's a lower body temperature. And so quite often the skin is the place where this bacteria likes to show up, but also the cranial nerves. We also know that it has a tropism or an attraction to nerves. And so the bacteria naturally latches onto to nerves and also brain cells.
Okay, now do you meet every Tuesday, is it?
No, the first Tuesday of each month at 7 p.m. at St. Luke's.
At 7 p.m. at St. Luke's.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
First Tuesday at 7 p.m. Okay, thank you so much. I hope you come on again.
Okay, and tell your sister Dorothy that she needs to get treatment if she still has symptoms. And if there's any Lyme patients out there that have had a history of being treated and then they've relapsed and continue to have symptoms, they should also seek medical treatment.
Yeah, she is being treated constantly for various things all the time, and they're trying to pinpoint. I thank you so much, Dr. Kirk.
Thank you very much. We are going to be taking a news break just here in a couple minutes, and then we're going to keep Tom here because I know that there are still folks out there that have questions and comments that would like to call in, so we're going to keep him past the news, and he'll be with us in our studio. He won't be able to stick around for the whole entire hour, so if you have your questions, be prepared to ask them when we get back from the news. The number here is 722-0839. Horton on 610 KDAL. The number here is 722-0839. Toll free, the number is 888-KDAL-610. And we are here visiting with Tom Greer. He is the executive director of the Minnesota You want to let us know again?
Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council.
Okay.
Mainly we try to help patients with Lyme disease.
Yes, and we were talking in the last hour about Lyme disease, and we did have quite a few phone calls during our break, so I'm going to try to go through some of the questions that the folks that called in during our news break had for you. One of the callers called in and said that her husband was being treated for Lyme disease, and she wanted to know what kind of treatment you have received, whether it was continuous treatment, and how often are you still being treated? Also, what would you recommend to Lyme disease patients? So okay. We'll start with that one.
Well, first of all, I'm not a physician, so I'm not going to recommend any specific treatment or length of time and such. I can tell you that for me, starting off was very difficult because the physicians really didn't understand this disease completely. And so they would treat you for a while, then they'd step back, then they'd treat you for a while and step back. And this yo-yo treatment is not a good thing, I don't think. And the reason why is this. If you get bit by a tick and you have the bacteria, one of the places it can survive for a while is the blood, but it's not going to stay in the bloodstream because it doesn't like it there. But while it's in the bloodstream, your white blood cells are going to make antibodies, and the antibodies is what we measure for the tests, and the antibodies is also what gives you natural immunity to help fight the illness. Once you treat with antibiotics, you're going to clear that infection from the bloodstream very quickly. And the patient might have temporary relief. They'll say, oh, I feel much, much better. I must be cured. But you haven't treated long enough to get to the infection that may be in the brain, the heart, the joint, or other sequestered areas. Now, once you remove the bacteria from the bloodstream, the blood says, why make antibodies anymore? And so antibody production goes down. Now your symptoms return, you go back to the doctor and you say, well, I still have Lyme disease. And he gives you a blood test and he says, no, you don't. You don't have any antibodies. Well, that's because you were treated with antibiotics. My feeling is in late stage Lyme disease, if we know that you have a multitude of symptoms and it's the general rule of thumb is if it's into more than two different systems of the body and you have more than three persistent symptoms, then you need to treat as though it's a long-term infection. And for different patients and different physicians, this can mean different things. But I would say you want to treat until all the symptoms are gone and then a little bit extra. And this is where the real controversy has come in. And there are actually doctors being sued in New York and other places. Like right now, Dr. Charles Ray Jones, just one of the most marvelous people I've ever met, extremely intelligent, is going through a medical board of review because of the way he treats Lyme patients aggressively, as particularly kids. And so it's a very controversial thing, and a lot of doctors don't want to get involved with this kind of complication. So the easiest thing to do is pass that patient along, and the patient keeps getting passed along from doctor to doctor. But I would say that if you have any chance at all of getting long-term continuous treatment until all your symptoms are gone, that's better than treating 2 weeks and then waiting a few months and seeing if your symptoms return. Because if the symptoms return, what does that tell you? It's bacteria that was in hard-to-reach places of the body, and certainly in that 3 months where you didn't treat, there's more bacteria and you're going to have more problems than you had before. So treating twice is harder than treating the first time.
Well, and then another caller that we had wanted you to repeat the book that is out there right now that you're recommending.
Okay. This is a friend of mine, Pamela Weintraub, who wrote this book. She spent several years investigating the controversies in Lyme disease and also the conflicts of interest that there are with various patents on tests and vaccines and so on. This is a very well-written book. She is a science writer for Discover Magazine, and the name of the book is Cure Unknown by Pamela Weintraub, and it has great big blaze orange lettering on the front, and it's still in hardcover.
Okay, now is that available at Barnes & Noble?
It is available at Barnes & Noble.
Okay, so people can go up there and they can pick it up.
For $27.95.
Okay, great. And so we are talking with Tom Greer. He is an expert in many ways because not only have you lived through this, and have lived with Lyme disease, you also have this background that really prepared you so that you could investigate it further. You know, we all know our bodies, but to also have that education prior, it gives you kind of an added leg up on a patient who doesn't have this background. Your background, you have your degree, a double degree in biology and chemistry. You also went on to do your postgraduate work in clinical immunology. You'll have to say that one. At the UMD Medical School, and then 1 year of postgraduate work at the University of Washington in the Puget Sound doing research under a grant for NASA in geriatrics and the effects of nutrition on bone wasting. So you have this background that even though you were, for 6 years you were suffering from what you thought was MS, and you were being told this, it wasn't until a doctor said, hey, wait a minute, we need to look at Lyme disease.
Well, from about 1988 to 1990, I really thought I had something different, but because it was affecting my heart, I was depressed and so on. But the doctors kept saying, well, that numbness and tingling in your hands and feet and your scalp and various other things, visual problems, optical neuritis, this all means MS. It has to be MS. They said 90% of optical neuritis leads to MS. And by the time I was hospitalized, they said I had rapid progressive relapsing form of multiple sclerosis. And then almost as soon as the Lyme disease was diagnosed, they backed off and said, well, no, he clearly doesn't have MS. And it's like, well, that's pretty capricious. I went through 2 years of suffering. And over the next 10 years, I spent about $250,000 in trying to get treatments and various things.
Well, let's talk about doctors, because one of the roles of your organization is to educate doctors also. How have doctors responded to the things that you have come out with your organization?
Well, I have to say that sometimes going into clinics and giving like this laptop presentation that I have here, I met with a lot of skepticism and even anger, and a lot of lab techs too. And then the lab techs kind of warm up when they know that actually in my pre-grad, I used to actually develop lab tests. And so I have a very good background in that sort of thing. University of Minnesota still has patents on the work that I did for antibody bacteria coated tests for differentiating pyelonephritis from cystitis and other tests like that. So I have a good technical background in those areas. So I would say going into the presentation, I met with a lot of skepticism and anger. But in the end, then they just have lots and lots of questions, and usually they come around.
Well, we have a caller right now, so we're going to go ahead and take that call. We have Carol on the line. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is there any type of insect repellent that helps to keep these ticks away from you?
Yes. And once again, there's a small controversy. We have a lot of pressure from big manufacturers to tell us to use DEET, the insect repellent for mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And DEET does work, and it's excellent for mosquitoes, I would say absolutely. But what we have found, and we did our own testing in Jay Cook State Park, if you really want to deter ticks, there's a product out there called permethrin. And it's available at stores that sell horse supplies, veterinary, but also there's a human product that's out there in a spray, and it's 0.5% permethrin. You cannot use it on your skin. The oils in your skin will deactivate it. Also, it's probably not a good thing to be absorbed through the skin. Mm-hmm. But you can spray it on your shoes, your socks, your pants, and so on. And once it dries, it'll stay active for months. Mm-hmm. And the ticks... What we did in Jay Cook State Park is we sprayed a shoe with a 35% DEET product, and then we sprayed a shoe 2 weeks earlier with the permethrin. So we took the old shoe and the recently sprayed shoe, and we put ticks near them to see what would happen. And the DEET shoe, the ticks would just walk off the shoe. But when they got even close to the permethrin-treated shoe, they curled up into a ball, and they could do nothing. And so, from my experience, the permethrin is a much, much better product for tick repellent.
Wow, that's good knowledge. And you can buy this, like, through veterinary things?
Well, you can here locally, if you go to Dan's Feed Bin in Superior or places like that, you can find products that were meant for horses that you actually spray on the horse and such, which you can use if it's 0.5% on your clothing and your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
This is also a product the military uses, and one of the things is it'll survive washings, so you can wash your clothes and still reuse them. So hunters that are going to be out in the woods all the time should really be using this product because they don't have to reapply it when they're out in the woods. And also, I think deer can smell DEET from a mile away. So.
Well, thanks for your call. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Thank you. That's very good information.
Thank you. We've got Chuck on the line. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Corinna. Good morning, Tom.
Oh, good morning.
Very nice to hear you on my wife's program. Stop.
Yeah, well, she's been very lovely and kind to me.
Well, she is very lovely kind and kind to other people. Her husband, sometimes not so much.
Well, we think the world of you, but sometimes we have to keep you in line.
Yeah. First off, I've been very interested in this topic. I think it's surprising how many people it affects. Here locally, and it's really nice that that you're fighting this thing, Tom, and you're learning about it, and you're helping others to fight it, and I appreciate your efforts.
Oh, thank you.
And then, Corinda, I have some very good news for you.
You do?
I've uncovered something for you, maybe later on in the week, for a program for you about the city employees that were fired mysteriously or nobody, and they quit the investigation.
Okay, well, I can't wait to hear that. Now, you had a question that I was supposed to ask on here about dementia. Do you want to go ahead and ask that question?
I think we'll have Tom on again. I mean, you know, I think we can talk about dementia and boxing another time. I think we should stay on topic. But I just want to say thank you, Tom, and then also, Corinda. I hope that you'll let me break the story on your radio program instead of going to others.
Okay, I'll take it. I'll take it.
By what?
I'll take it. You can come on and you can break the story.
Okay.
All right.
Have a good day.
But I got to review it a little bit beforehand.
Oh, believe me, you're not going to believe the information I got.
Okay, well, I can't wait to hear about it. Bye. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break right now. When we return, we're going to keep Tom here, but he's only going to be here until the top of the news. So that means if you have any questions or comments for Tom today, you want to get those in right now. Because he'll have to be going off. He's got another job that he has to go do, and he's going to be going to do that. So if you'd like to call in, the number is 722-0839. And if you want to call long distance, 888-KDAL-610. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610-KDAL. Hi, this is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610-KDAL. We are here with Tom Greer, the Executive Director for a Minnesota nonprofit organization to help educate doctors and patients about Lyme disease. And we have a caller on the line. Melissa, you are on the air.
Hi, Corinda.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on. I have a question for your guest. Last summer, my youngest daughter came down with Lyme disease. And based on everything that we know about Lyme disease, I should have recognized it right away, but I didn't. But anyway, she was diagnosed immediately once we brought her in, and she was treated and she was cured. But being that they track the statistics of the location and whatnot, the Minnesota State Health Department contacted me. And a question I had for them was where they're at in the creation of a vaccine for this thing. I have a vaccine that I give my dog. You know, they've got them for dogs, but not for humans. And they didn't really have a good answer for me as far as where they're at in the process of trying to come up with this. Do you know anything about the progress of a vaccine for humans?
Yes, I do. First of all, there's two vaccines available for dogs, and I would recommend either one of them, but the newer vaccine tends to give you a little bit longer period of time of immunity in your pet. This vaccine is sometimes used also by other people, like in their horses and such, even though it's indicated for dogs. For humans, one of the real problems is economics and politics. You know, there used to be a saying, publish or perish. Now it's kind of patent or perish. So everything that researchers do, you know, the people that are funding the money want to have patents. They want to see an economic result. Well, early on in Lyme disease, one of the patents was for a protein on this bacteria called outer surface protein A. And unfortunately, that protein had also been associated with joint damage in people. And there was research in both people and animal models that supported this very, very clearly before they ever went into the research. But rather than paying royalties to other people like in Europe and such to use their proteins and antigens, they chose to go ahead with this OspA. Well, the OspA vaccine came out, and people that had a certain tissue type called HLA-DR4, it's not too important, but about one-fourth of all people have this tissue type, well, they would develop arthritis sometimes in reaction to this vaccine. Well, there was a question, is it really the vaccine? Is it something else? Had they been priorly infected with Lyme disease? Well, eventually it led to several class action lawsuits, and the vaccine was voluntarily pulled off the market. And we have somebody in support group today who has never had documented Lyme disease, but is completely disabled because of reactions that he's had. And so it's a very political thing right now. Well, it costs about $100 million to bring a vaccine to market. Now, there's two vaccines being produced in Europe that are not available yet, and I would love to see them in America because they are very, very scientifically, I think, important. I think they would be good vaccines. But are they ever going to release it in America? It's going to cost $100 million to go through the FDA, and are they going to be sued? So I think we're not going to see a vaccine soon.
Tom, Melissa, we have to take the news right now. We're going to have Tom on our show again, and if you have more questions, we'll get Melissa, I'll put you in touch with Tom, and we'll make sure that you get your answer to those questions. We've got the phone is ringing off the hook. We've got to take this news break. When we return, Tom's going to be gone, but we can continue our discussion. Hi, this is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610. And in the last hour and a half, we have Tom Greer, who was visiting us. He was the executive director for MIBDEC, a local Minnesota nonprofit organization to help educate doctors and patients. And when he left, he told me, he said, I can go toe-to-toe with any doctor out there if they disagree with some of the things that he has brought up, because he has over 3,000 hard copy references, and he definitely has researched this. We have a phone caller. No, they had a question for Tom.
Yes.
Tom is going to be back now, folks. I already scheduled him back in my calendar. So for those of you who are interested in hearing him again and making sure, you know, if you have questions or concerns that you'd like to ask him, he is now scheduled for March 2nd. It's a Monday morning at 10 o'clock. He's going to be on my show March 2nd. So the first Monday of March, we're going to have Tom on our show, and that way we can continue to ask questions and hear from him. You know, some of the stuff that he left me is amazing. He said here, in present day, today most of our research dollars have been spent on studying ticks and deer and not the human disease process. We know about as much about this disease as we did in 1990. Today, thousands of patients every year are told the disease is easy to diagnose and treat, yet we continue to have thousands of frustrated patients with lingering symptoms due to lack of access and insurance denial for aggressive and extended drug therapies as needed in the disease. So, why is Lyme disease being singled out as a disease doctors refuse to treat? You know, there's just there's a lot of stuff going on, and there is controversy and anything with anything that has to do with the human body. There's going to be some controversy for sure. I mean, we have it when we talk about immunizations, whether we should give our kids immunizations or whether we should or should not. I mean, so that is happening right now. And you see cases of people who are having now the measles and the mumps because they didn't give their kids the immunization that they needed. And then there's also research on the other side that says if you give your kids immunizations, that there could be other things that could affect and inflect your children. So there is always going to be controversy when we talk about the human body and what's best for us. Also, he mentioned the book Cure Unknown. You can get it at Barnes & Noble that also talks about some of this with this disease. Al, you are on the air with Corinda Horton. Good morning.
Good morning. The reason I called is, you know, you were talking with that doctor about shots for the human person.
Yeah, he was the immunization for Lyme disease.
Yeah, Lyme disease, immunization.
Yeah, I had a hard time saying it.
But anyway, I had I was going to a doctor, and he gave me two shots.
Okay.
For Lyme disease, or for immunization.
Of Lyme disease.
For Lyme disease, and then all of a sudden they quit it.
Oh, okay.
And I was just wondering if there's any side effects, but I haven't noticed anything, just that I'm getting old, that's all.
Yeah, well, and that's the other piece, is that as we age, there's so many things that crop up. I came back from the first Gulf War, and there was this Persian Gulf syndrome, and so, you know, it was really hard for people to really know what is this disease and how much of it is, you know, the aging process or where we're at with our age. I don't know the answer to that, Al, and Tom's left us, but he's going to be back on March 2nd.
Okay, then my daughter, she had Lyme disease, and she had all these symptoms. You know, she was tired, fatigued,
mm-hmm.
until I went to a veterinarian, and I picked up a card about Lyme disease, and on the back they had listed all the symptoms that she had.
Mm.
Depression and the whole ball of wax. So I got more information from the veterinarian's waiting room than I did from any other doctors, because she was on shots and taking antibiotics and everything, but now she's doing pretty good.
So she's doing good. That's good. That's good to hear that. I think there are more people that have Lyme disease than we really know that are out there struggling.
Yes, that's true, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your call. And one of the other things that Tom had mentioned on his way out the door when we were visiting during the news break is that that a lot of times for politics, they don't want it to be known how many cases of Lyme disease are out there, because we also, on the other hand, want to have people coming and hunting and fishing and tourism and all of those other numbers that we want to have up there. And when we start talking about having Lyme disease and being able to catch Lyme disease up in this area or in Wisconsin, they start saying, wait a minute, we don't want to have those numbers out there because we don't want to discourage people from coming into our area and doing these activities and spending money up here. So there are, I'm sure there's a lot of politics that get into play looking at how much information gets out there and how much information doesn't. The other thing that he said is that when the media interviews somebody on this subject, oftentimes they only have so much room to put the information in the paper or in an article. And so they're oftentimes they stop right at the bullseye approach, so to speak, where they talk about the symptoms that you may have, and then they put that into the article, and that's all you get. You don't get the deeper discussion about it because there's no room in the paper to go on and on and on. But there is so much more to learn about it. And for all of us up here, we need to know. I mean, knowledge, you know, we talk about ignorance is bliss, and if we walk around and we don't know, then it's not going to affect us. But knowing something actually can help to prevent, you know, some of the things that people have gone through, some of the struggles that they have gone through with they've been missing.